Hello and welcome to Ask the Soul Doctors with Dr. Mark Pitstick. We're talking about soul proof, soul evidence, and the word soul proof has a dual meaning. First of all, there's lots of proof, a vast and varied amount of evidence, scientific, clinical, religious / spiritual, and first-hand experience evidence in nature, that we each really are infinite beings of energy, spirit, consciousness, awareness, whatever term you're most comfortable with. The second meaning of soul proof is that we each are soul proof, like a watch is waterproof or shockproof. That is, we each truly have everything we need to get through all of life's changes and challenges in style. Now, that may not jibe with your experience so far, but it really helps when you know who you are, why you're here, who always walks beside within you always. That opens up all sorts of resources, changes the whole name of the game, and we'll be talking about this. But today I want to answer the 10 most commonly asked questions I've received over the years from people around the world, so they may very well be your questions as well. I know that life on Earth can be tough at times. An earthly incarnation is definitely not for sissies, but it can be a work of art. It can be a magnificent adventure and a fulfilling adventure when you are realized or enlightened. And so we'll be discussing some topics that will help you maybe look at the big picture a little more. Quantum physicists are in agreement that the average human can only perceive much less than 1% of reality. They say that if all of the light and energy that exists, and that's the most absolute understanding of the nature of reality, light and energy, if all of that exists in our world were the size of Mount Everest, the portion that the average human can see, sense, would only be the size of a golf ball. So the average human is much like looking through a wall, through a little pinhole, and trying to describe what's going on, kind of like the blind man and the elephant. So let's see if we can open that pinhole a bit, make more sense of what's going on so that your everyday can be more successful, more happy, energetic, fulfilling. Now, keep in mind that what I'll be discussing, the answers I'll be providing, are my current understandings. And those are based on the soul proof evidence that I researched for 30 years, my personal experiences and belief, what makes the most sense to me. But you need to trust your inner voice and also what you've learned in other places. So I'm not here to be a guru. I am here to provide some information that hopefully will help. So the first question that we get asked, of course, one of the existential questions is, who am I? Is that you are a timeless being of energy, spirit, consciousness, awareness. You are the light of the world, as Jesus said, and so that's why you don't want to hide your light under a bushel. You're an integral part of all that is. So we say that God could be kind of like a divine ocean, and we each are like drops of water in that ocean. But integral parts, very important parts, if there weren't those drops of water, there wouldn't be an ocean. And like water, your essence can change, your outward appearance, rather, can change. So you know that ice can look like steam, or it can look like water, or look and look like water or ice. Well, likewise, you know, we can have a body, or we can be in a spirit form, a non-physical or formless form. But our essence, our real self, again, that energy, consciousness, awareness, that exists nonetheless. Lots of research makes that very clear, that consciousness survives independently, even beyond the physical death and before this human birth. We each are what I call WISPs. I like acronyms. WISP, W-I-S-P, stands for wise, infinite, special, and powerful beings. In other words, sometimes when people hear talk of consciousness, energy, awareness, they're like, well, what about the part of me that likes apple pie and likes the hug and remembers, you know, grandma's cooking and so on? Well, everything that you've ever done and ever been in any time and place becomes part of who you are. You don't lose anything. You just, when you pass on, you become much more than you could ever realize. But your personality, your memories, all becomes, again, part of your totality. Now, ideally, over time, the negative, the lower energy burns away, drops away, and you get more and more refined in your energy. So that at some point you realize you are one with the One, you're part of Source, and start living accordingly. And that, of course, is one of the goals. The second question we get asked the most is, why am I here? Okay, so if I'm this being of energy, what am I doing here? What's this all about? Well, I, again, have an acronym for that, and the word is SAGE, S-A-G-E. To help you remember, the S stands for service, service to others, helping your neighbor as yourself. The A is for adventure. This is one reason why we humans like plays, books, movies, and so on that have heroes and heroines, because that's what we really are. It takes a brave soul to come to a place like Earth. And so this is an exciting adventure. But when we remember that, then we're up to the challenge. We realize we volunteered for it, we co-created it, and so we can remember the name of the game, so to speak. Remember that life is an amazing adventure or is nothing at all, as Helen Keller said. The G stands for growth, lessons. Earth is one of the most sought-after places for souls to incarnate, I'm told, because it's such a fruitful place for growth. In other words, if you go to the gym and stand there and curl a pencil, you wouldn't get very much bicep growth, would you? But if you're curling a 60-pound dumbbell, you're going to get some muscle growth. Well, likewise, if life is easy all the time and everything's perfect, there's not the contrast, there's not the resistance that helps us grow and learn. And so certainly there is that on Earth for us. And then the E in SAGE stands for enjoyment. It's also a very, very beautiful place when we open our eyes, when we look at the positive as well as the negative. And there are certain enjoyments here that aren't available in non-physical realms. The movie Awakenings about Dr. Oliver Sacks temporary freeing people with Parkinson's with a drug beautifully depicted just how amazing life is when we wake up, when we open our eyes, and when we realize the beauty around us. So that's one reason we're here, SAGE training. Another is that, as I mentioned, we, as people who have had near-death experiences report almost across the board, we each are one with the One and part of Source. So we are a part of this phenomena, God. And God is not a concrete phenomena. It's an expanding phenomena. God is still growing. God is still expanding. That's one of the original meanings of the word heaven, expanding. And so I see what is going on kind of like a giant amoeba going through the cosmos, and little pseudopods reaching out are like each one of us, and we're experimenting, we're discovering, we're learning, we're growing, and all this gets reported back to the One. It's a beautiful system, and it's really mind-blowing at some point, but let me reassure you that you're part of this totally safe and magnificent adventure through eternity. Another question that's often asked is, what happens after I die? And the first answer to that is, you really don't die. No one really dies. Remember, we talked about that our human senses perceive much less than 1% of reality. So to the human eye, it looks like when someone's body dies, that's it, that's the end of them, when in fact it couldn't be further from the truth. If you're middle-aged or an adult or older, think back to an overcoat you wore when you were 5 years old. And at some point, you outgrew that, and you don't still miss it. And when you quit wearing that coat, you certainly didn't end your existence. Well, that's basically what the human body is, an overcoat, kind of like a car that gets us from womb to tomb. And at some point, it drops away. Now, some cultures recognize this. In India, for example, they call dying dropping the body. They'll say, hey, where's Ram? I haven't seen him for a while. Oh, he dropped his body. You know, no big deal. Same way with Native American culture. Another word they had for death was changing worlds. And it's a beautiful, much more accurate description of what really happens. We're changing worlds. So your real self, again, does not die. But secondly, so what about the details? All right, if I don't die and I go on to this next page of an eternal book, then what's it like? Well, that depends on your consciousness at the time of your passing on. In other words, you hear the saying, you can't take it with you. Well, the only exception is that what you take with you is who you are, your degree of love, your degree of realization, your energy level. And then wherever you go, that's what it's going to be like on the other side. So I use, when I talk about this, two extreme examples. Mother Teresa, for example, widely known saint, served people her whole life, very aware that she was serving God in distressful disguises. And so when she passed on, it was probably much like walking from one room to the other. Oh, Mother Teresa, you're back with us here. You're back home. Welcome. You know, we after you rest up a bit, we have some work for you to do. We have some souls that need mended here. We need some teaching, helping that needs to be done. So for her, a seamless transition into the next phase of forever. For Hitler, of course, a different story. Committed such heinous crimes, made so many people suffer. No, he was not alone in that. And yes, he was abused as a child. So there can be some understanding about that. So he doesn't experience a fiery eternal hell, but he does experience a self-induced hell, which can seem like eternity. So from our understandings of the research, someone like Hitler would first sleep for a long, long time because he couldn't even stand to look at the effects of what he did. You know, you hear about life reviews. When a person nearly dies, they have a life review and then they come back to tell about it. Well, same way when you die, you review your life and you not only watch it, but you feel what you put out to others. You feel the ripples. And so someone like Hitler couldn't even stand the life review. So a long period of sleep, a long period of counseling and healing. And in truth, everything about him that was evil and imbalanced will have to be burned away. That's what the hellfires are about. Burning away the old, burning away the lower energies, so that then what is left is that pure soul, that energy and consciousness we've talked about. So if you've burned it away and don't carry a bunch of crap with you from the earthly life, when you pass on will be a lot like heaven. If you don't, it can be hellish for a while, but just for a while. Remember, eternity is a long, long time. Another common question we get is, why see my departed loved ones again? And the answer, of course, is we've talked about how there's no such thing as death. Of course you do. People hear about reunions when you pass on. When people have near-death experience, they will see their loved ones lined up, even beloved pets that have passed on. So you can be sure that there is a lovely reunion waiting for you when you do cross over, when you drop your body. However, the good news is that you don't have to wait until you die to perceive your departed loved ones. Over 75 million Americans have had what are called after-death contacts, or ADCs for short. The breakdown is 25% of average Americans, 66% of widows and widowers, and a full 75% of parents whose children have passed on. It's an incredible number. And so many of these are documented. That is, it's obvious that it's not just wishful thinking or imagination. There is evidence that comes along with these visits that show that they are indeed true. So lots of after-death contacts. So when a departed loved one passes on, keep your eyes open. Keep your senses alert. Little events that happen, you may just cast off, oh, I must be losing my mind or something. Those can be the visits, especially tampering with electronic instruments seem to be one of the most easy things for those in the non-physical realms. Now, a second question that comes with this is, well, okay, if there are these after-death contacts, as many people have them, why haven't my departed loved ones contacted me? I just gave a workshop last week, and a woman asked, why hasn't my father contacted me? Well, first of all, it's not an easy feat to communicate from one dimension to another. And soul time is different from earth time. So let's say you're a loved one that's been passed on for 2 years. Well, it may seem like 5 minutes to them in the spirit world, and they're still kind of getting their bearings and going through the healing showers and the counseling and the reorientation. But one of the biggest reasons why humans don't perceive visits from the other side is because of their energy is not receptive. In other words, you need to be on the same wavelength. It's like you need to be tuned into a certain radio frequency, excuse me, to listen to that radio show. So in non-physical realms, usually the energy is peaceful, harmonious, loving. But if your energy is fearful, anxious, and frantic, you're not going to be able to communicate. So that's why a lot of after-death contacts occur during sleep, during dreams, when the mind is quiet, and the person then can experience this visit during a dream, so to speak. But again, there are validated dreams that show that it's sometimes more than just a dream. The fifth question that we get the most questions about from around the world is, are there really ghosts? And if so, what are they and can they hurt me? Well, today's Halloween day, so a great day for that. Well, the statistics are that 1 out of 5 in the United States have experienced a ghost contact, and 50% of Americans believe in ghosts. What you may not know is there are actually university studies, for example, UCLA, Cambridge in England, that have done well set up scientific studies that show something is going on, primarily by light, photographs in popular photography. So the research is there to show that, yes, there are some what we call stuck spirits. So let's talk about that. We mentioned near-death experiences where a person will pass on, they'll see the light, they'll go into the light, and then later on they're told it's not their time yet, or they'll decide to come back. Well, with ghosts, it appears that these souls, when they die, don't enter the light for a number of reasons. And those can include, first of all, they have totally no spiritual beliefs. They absolutely reject any idea of that. So when they pass on, their belief system is there's nothing. Another reason would be if a person had a violent, sudden death, totally unexpected, and they're in shock, so to speak, when they pass on. Again, they may not see the light or decide to enter it. If a soul, recently departed soul, has revenge or has strong emotions like anger, then they may not want to die. They want to come back and get revenge. Say they were killed by a jealous lover. They want to come back and get revenge, perhaps, so they're not ready to move on. Likewise, if there are addictions to food, materialism, sex, alcohol, drugs. Some psychic mediums report going to bars and seeing that the drunker a person gets, the more ghosts they have around them, these ghosts trying to get a contact high. They can't drink alcohol, you know, in where they're at. So those are about ghosts. Now, the next question is, can these ghosts hurt us? And the answer is no, they cannot. But they can scare you a lot. They can make your hair stand up on end. They can make you do crazy things like running into a wall and falling down the stairs. But that's not the ghost hurting you. That's you hurting yourself. Now, some people wonder about the difference between ghosts and departed loved ones who visit during an after-death contact. And usually, it's a pretty clear difference. Ghost visits are generally a feeling of darkness, a feeling of coldness, sometimes a feeling of helplessness, certainly fear, lots of negative feelings, and being haunted by the stuck souls in between worlds. After-death contacts, on the other hand, are characterized by peaceful feelings, by light, by reassurance that your departed loved one is alive and well, and they leave the person feeling very hopeful and at peace that they know their loved one is doing fine and they'll see each other again. Now, sometimes the difference isn't always so clear-cut. One woman from Germany wrote me telling about her house was haunted for some time, stamping up and down up the stairs and the windows opening and closing, and she went on with that for a couple weeks, and then one night she realized, oh my God, it's her ex-son-in-law. She hadn't seen him for a while, but he was killed in the war, and she realized he was stuck. He got killed in such a way that he didn't have the wherewithal to enter the light. And so she just prayed for him. She said, oh, I'm so sorry. It took me this long to figure it out. I know what you went through is horrible, but just look around you. You'll see the light. It's waiting for you. Just enter it. Trust God. You know, we love you, but I know you're not happy, and I know you don't mean to scare us, so just enter the light. And after she did that, there were no other experiences like that happening again. So it really can be that simple. Now, there are ghostbusters, sometimes shamans, energy workers, people who specialize in this sort of work. So if simple prayer and visualization like that doesn't work, then you might want to call on someone who has some experience. And if that doesn't work, I think Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray are still doing some ghostbusting on the side. Check that out. All right, the next question, what happens to the life force of people who commit suicide? This is a tough one. At an early age, I was doing suicide crisis counseling and education speaking. So I've been around quite a bit of my life. I worked in hospitals. I was with a lot of people who died as a result of suicide and around other people who didn't die as a result of suicide. So I know it's tough for everybody involved. But it's not the unforgivable sin, as is murmured sometimes, and it's certainly not a one-way ticket to hell. This information about suicides comes from authentic mediums, from after-death contacts of souls who have come back to visit, who took their own lives, from spiritual regressions done by a therapist trained by Michael Newton, Ph.D., and also from near-death experience reports of. Much of what I'm talking about here, again, has research and documentation behind it. So what happens to the life force of the person who commits suicide, kind of like when a person dies in general, depends on the reasons for taking their own life. In other words, there was a couple years ago in New York, he was a minister of the United Church of Christ Church, and his wife was losing her mind, and he was losing his physical capabilities. He couldn't get around. He had severe arthritis and lots of pain. He was going downhill, and he just saw what the future was like, nursing home for both of them. And they decided to take their lives in a peaceful way, and that was their decision. What I hear about that is that the light understands that. Certainly the angels and heavenly hosts understand that at some point it's time to pass on. And otherwise, in other words, in other times, people would have died naturally. You know, when we were pioneers and out in the woods, the old folks just had to be left behind, and the elements, the animals would kill them mercifully. Now we supposedly mercifully keep them alive in nursing homes, so they're curled up, contractured with pneumonia, and they're unconscious, or they've lost their minds, or on a ventilator. I've been around lots of this. That's not normal or natural either. On the other hand, if a person commits suicide for an impulsive reason, let's say a teenager's first love breaks up with them, and it's like it's the end of the world, and just goes out and kills himself or herself over that. That wasn't very good reason, really. That person had waited just a little while, it was seen that life continues on. Like most of us have had that agony of heartbreak. Now, that doesn't mean that the teenager who killed him or herself goes to hell or anything, but it's less well-received with the spiritual support team that's kind of like, oh, man, did you really do that? And usually a soul in that situation just decides to come back into a similar scenario so the next time they can rise to the occasion and meet that challenge rather than taking their own life. We live in a tough time right now. The 21st century has lots of advantages, but there are some really serious health concerns and that I deal with with my training as a clinical psychologist and a doctor of chiropractic. Heavy metals and chemicals especially abound in our food, air, and water, and body care products and home cleaning products and lots of sources. And the brain is very sensitive to these toxins. And some people, they're like canaries in a coal mine. They are signaling. They're the vanguard that's hopefully going to wake the rest of humanity up like, hey, these things are killing us and they're making us go crazy. And this is one reason why so many people are having so many physical and, quote, mental symptoms. The brain is just bombarded. Poor nutrition, inadequate nutrients, and a number of other factors I just can't get into. But the point is that I understand why a person may take their life. There are lots of number of reasons. Certainly, Creator, the ground of all being, the source of all love, understands as well. So hopefully that helps. I know this is a short coverage of a tough topic, but hopefully if you've had someone who's taken their life, that helps you know it's not an unforgivable sin, nor is there any such thing. The next topic we're going to start before our next break is there a God? And if so, what is he like? Well, first of all, God is not a big guy in the sky. And he's certainly not a he. God is without gender. In other words, we're created in God's image, not the other way around. In the Aramaic language, the language spoken at the time of Jesus, the word God meant unity, consciousness. And from the German translation, God came from the same as good, gut. There have been various names from different cultures for the Creator. One is Great Spirit from Native Americans, All That Is from the Middle Eastern cultures. People who have near-death experiences talk a lot about the light, embraced by the light. They also use the word the presence. It's almost like a background energy. The presence. And they say that we each are like passengers on a train, and God is driving the train. I hate to say it, but I think that the movies, Star Wars, actually did a better job representing this phenomena, the Force, may the Force be with you, than a lot of religions have. A lot of people are atheists or agnostics, understandably, because of the nonsensical images of God that are portrayed in traditional religions. First, on one hand, saying God is a God of love, and then on the next hand, you'll go to hell forever and burn if you don't do certain things or believe a certain way. It's schizophrenic, and most people who think for themselves pick that up really quickly. So the good news is we each are one with this one, as near-death experiences say. We each are one with the one and part of Source, so we're part of that. And it's a wonderful setup. Another question we get a lot is, how can I best hear the voice of my higher self? Higher self, of course, being a synonym for soul, spirit. Father Thomas Keatings has a wonderful quote. He says, "Silence is the language God speaks, and everything else is a bad translation." And so it's true. And so really to hear your inner voice and to hear the voice of God, and really it's part and parcel the same, it's important to quiet the mind. Our brains, our twin cerebral cortexes are wonderful computers. They can do lots of things. But they can also they can miss the big picture. As we say, they only pick up less than 1% of reality. So that's why it's important to regularly engage in what are called centering practices, ways to get quiet within and realize we each are one with the universe, and life is going to work out just fine. This life story we're in has a happy ending, even though it doesn't seem like it at the time. So centering practices can be seated meditations. I've meditated for 40 years, but some people people don't like to sit, really, and they're more comfortable with walking meditations, like walking in the woods, walking in the surf along the ocean, walking by a stream, especially nature, lots of chi, lots of energy there from the earth, from the water, from the wind, from the sky. And so you pick that up, and then your chi flows more. Chi meaning life force, breath, spirit, reminding us of our true nature. For some people, it's crocheting, knitting, gardening, playing with children, playing with pets, serving others. Again, whatever helps quiet the mind and helps remind you of the big picture. And that it's okay. It really is okay. In my workshops, I teach several experiential techniques. One's called transformational breath work, and then a number of people, Stan Grof, Jacqueline Small, Rusty Masters, and others who teach different techniques, transformational breath work. I do a technique under hypnosis called Ask Your Soul, where we hypnotize a group of people and allow them to get in touch with their inner wisdom and ask questions. Are you living in your right place? Are you doing your best life work? Is this relationship working for you? And so on. Wonderful way to get in touch with your inner voice. And so these workshops are available around the country, and I'll be getting them on the soulproof.com website as soon as possible as well. The ninth question is, why do people, especially children, have to suffer and die? These are big questions. I know these are tough questions. I've been with children as they die, children who were abused to death, children who were run over by trucks. I worked in hospitals. So I know this is a tough one, and it is the toughest challenge. Change and challenges are part of life, but suffering is optional when you're an enlightened being, when you realize the big picture, when you realize no one really dies. Native Americans did not have a word for the concept of fear. When European settlers came over, they were surprised to find this. The Native Americans didn't understand the concept of fear. Like, what is there to fear? You know, if we die today, if we're paralyzed, whatever, life is an eternal walk with great spirit. What is there to fear? What could go wrong? And that's the essence of this. Like the Bible talks about building your house on granite, not shifting sand. So when you really understand what's going on, then the suffering is much, much less. Yeah, you can be sad, you're going to grieve some, but not nearly to the extent if you didn't have this spiritual foundation. Now, one cause of suffering is an over-identification with aspects that change. In other words, if a person is over-identified with their body, with their beauty, with their youth, you're going to lose all those eventually. And that's why it's important to identify with your timeless nature, your spirit, your consciousness, love, caring for others, and so on. Those things don't go away. Those things don't die. The Buddha was asked about suffering. Why is there suffering? He said two reasons. Number one, growth opportunities. You learn, you grow when you suffer. And number two, it provides opportunities for serving others. Short and sweet, covers a lot of bases, makes sense to me. Now, when a child dies, again, it's tough, but it's important to remember that even though a child might be a child in Earth years or from our on Earth right now, it could be a very evolved or advanced soul and therefore didn't need a long, long lifetime. So whether a person is 5 years old or 95 years old when they pass on, this time on Earth is just a blink of an eye in the span of eternity. Again, the Buddha said, you want to know what a human life is like? Go down by the ocean and watch the waves break. And you know, there's just that little bit of froth, a few drops that shoot up into the air for a moment and then fall back into the water. That's how short, that's how transient a human life is. So most of the time, we're home, we're in heaven, we're in spirit world, we're part of the divine ocean. But once in a while, I say, you know, I'm going to have an experience, like taking a vacation or watching a movie. I'm going to have this incarnation in this time and place. And it's over in a heartbeat, a blink of an eye, and then we go back to the one. And so when you realize that suffering is worth it if you grow, if you serve others, if you learn, even for the adventure. Another important topic on this is that we each volunteer for these tough times. There's good evidence that we as souls choose the sorts of things that will happen in a life. In other words, suffering is not put on us by God, and that makes a big difference. It's not enforced by a dictatorial God, but rather we choose it. The 10th most common asked question from people around the world is, how can I make peace with the religious teachings of my youth? As an adult, I don't agree with some of the things they teach. For example, there's an eternal hell, there's only one way to God, being gay is a sin, and other things that seem nonsensical to me now. Yet there was a lot of good about my early religious teachings, and I'd like to make peace with that. How do I deal with that? This is a great question, a very important one, and one that I hope creates a dialogue that results in the church's strengthening and being more responsive to people's needs. I attended a Methodist theological school majoring in pastoral counseling, and so I learned for myself that in the biblical history, the Bible has been changed mightily through translations, interpretations, deletions, additions. Then, as in now, powerful men usually took advantage of the opportunity, took advantage of the trust for power and fame, and changed things so they can control people. So that's one reason why there are things taught in churches and the Bible and other holy books that they have been changed, and they don't resonate with that voice within, even to little children. So first of all, I encourage people to recognize that the churches are doing the best they can with what they had to work with before they concretized. When I was writing my book, Soul Proof, I called around all the different denominations and asked, what do your churches believe about hell? And one of the churches, I won't name the name of the denomination, said, well, our canons from 1456 clearly state that there is a fiery eternal hell. And I said, I know, in 1456, but I mean, what does your church believe now? And there was this pause, and he said, well, we still go by those canons. And I thought, oh my God, you know, what? Those were the dark, and they called them the dark ages for a reason, people. Hello. So they were doing the best they can. But now there's new information out there, and that needs to be recognized. Second, I recommend that people sift through the information and keep the diamonds and let go of the rest. Thomas Jefferson said that he believed the truth is embedded in the Bible like diamonds in a dung heap. And I have to agree with him on that. So sift through and keep the good and let go of what doesn't make sense to you. Churches have a lot of faults. Only 19% of Americans regularly attend for good reason. But they also do a lot of good. They serve a lot of people. They have soup kitchens, and they do a lot of good outreaches. So I think rather than just throw away the baby with the bathwater, perhaps it's time for change within. Some churches are being more open, more responsive to people's needs. I have a dear friend who's 85, Episcopalian minister. In the 1950s, he had a large church, and he wanted to include blacks in the church. And the next week, only half the people showed up. And then, of course, there's a big battle about gays now. So it's time just to let go of all that and quit looking at the outward differences and realizing we're all children of God. We're all one big family. And that's when the churches will grow. I recommend that Sunday schools discuss these soul-proof topics. May not agree with them, but at least it's interesting topics for dialogue. So bottom line, I recommend that people honor and learn from ancient views, from the contemporary evidence, and most of all, trust their inner voice, their inner wisdom about this. So I hope all of this helps. That's the 10th question. I hope all this helps deal with the challenges and changes in life. Again, the more you realize all this, the more you realize life truly is a totally safe and magnificent adventure amidst eternity. Again, you volunteered for it. You're an adventurer. You're a swashbuckler. And that way, whatever's going on, instead of you feeling like a helpless victim, you'll realize this is an opportunity to be a hero, to have a breakthrough, to learn, grow, and serve others. And that changes the whole ballgame, so to speak. Life is wonderful. And again, when we're spiritually awakened, that becomes very clear, and then we can have that successful, that fulfilling life that is possible. Love and light is all that ultimately exists. So remember that, and most of all, remember that you're soul-proof. Just like, again, a watch is shock-proof or waterproof. You can handle whatever comes along. That's why the saying, God never gives us more than we can handle, that's true, even though it may not seem like it at times. In fact, when my dad passed on 7 years ago, that was one of the last things he said. He said, you know, it's funny. You hear that saying, God never gives you more than you can carry. But as you go through life, it sure doesn't seem like it. But when you get to the point like me and you've got 1 foot in the next realm and you look at the whole thing, you realize it really is true. So hopefully that helps you. It's helped a lot of people. I had a woman recently who wrote me. Her six-month-old son was premature. He was in the hospital for 6 months, his whole life. And it was such a battle. And finally, he was at the point where the doctor said he could come home the next week. Well, he had a tracheotomy and a hole in his throat that he was breathing through. And during the night, the tube slipped. The air was going stuff down to his lungs, inside his body, and he blew up like a balloon. The alarm was faulty on the ventilator. And so the mother came in the morning to find her little baby boy she's expecting to bring home dead and blown up like a balloon. If you can imagine the pain. Luckily, someone shared with her Soul Proof, both the Soul Proof book, and we have a documentary film, a 93-minute movie. And she wrote me a letter, and she said, if it hadn't been for this, I don't know what I would have done. I think I would have died. And in fact, afterwards, she wrote me again, and she said she had been having a number of after-death contacts. Pictures of him were turning, were falling over. His shoes would move from one room to another. And she said, if I had known about this, I would have thought I was going crazy. But with the knowledge I got from Soul Proof, I realized, this little guy is visiting me. He's telling me he's okay. And the postscript is, 2 years later, she had another little boy who was born healthily, and she felt like it was the same spirit coming through again. So life really is much more beautiful and wondrous than we can imagine. Remember, we're looking through that peephole. So hopefully this will expand the view a little bit so you can see the big picture. I'll give you another example. When I started working in the hospitals when I was 20 years old, my very first case after receiving all the training went down, and a little boy, 5 years old, had been hit by a truck on his way to kindergarten, his first day of kindergarten. We worked on him for 4 hours, and despite our best efforts, he passed on. I went out into the hall just in time to see the head doctor tell his parents that their only child had died, and I went outside then and shook my fist in the sky and said, God, what good are you if you even exist? I'm not sure you even do anymore. That horrible tragedy 40 years ago motivated me to go to theology school, become a psychologist, do holistic health care, to research all the soul proof evidence for 30 years, and now to share it in every way I can. So you tell me, from the big viewpoint, was his death a horrible tragedy, or was it a big victory? Think of the impact he had, and I'm sure his death had impact on other people as well. So that's a great example of looking at the big picture. So think upon these things. Talk about them with others. Ask other people, you know, have they had after-death contacts? What do they think about this? Is there really a heaven and hell? And what do they think happens after they die? In other words, this is important stuff to talk about now so that you're prepared. I was an Eagle Boy Scout, and that was our motto, be prepared. Well, be prepared for life now, and notice how this life gets so much more wonderful when you answer for yourself those ultimate questions. I'm Dr. Mark Pitstick. You're listening to Ask the Soul Doctor.